This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. A lethal disease gradually devastating bat populations across the eastern U.S. is slowly spreading in Wisconsin. White nose syndrome and the fungus that causes it have now been confirmed in 8 Wisconsin counties, mostly in the southwestern driftless region of the state. There have also been signs of it spreading into isolated parts of northeast Iowa and southeast Minnesota. UW-Platteville biology professor Jeff Hibschman and Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Species Management Section Chief Owen Boyle have been studying the issue. They explained to Wisconsin Public Radio's Maureen McCollum why white nose syndrome is a growing concern.
What white nose syndrome is a disease that's caused by a fungus that is not native to the U.S. As researchers have been able to determine, it was originally found in Europe and likely brought here to the U.S. Transported accidentally, and introduced first found in a cave in upstate New York in 2006. The fungus doesn't kill the bats directly. The bats that are most impacted by this fungus are what we call cave bats, and these are bats that spend the winter hibernating rather than migrating out of the state. And as you know, bats are insectivores. They eat insects, and thankfully in Wisconsin there are no insects in winter. The way that they cope with that lack of food is by hibernating. And while they're doing that, their metabolisms are much slowed, their core body temperatures drop, and they're not burning energy as quickly. Unfortunately, what the fungus does is continues to wake them up and causes them to burn energy that they wouldn't normally. And unfortunately, they have no way to replace that energy. So basically, by the end of the winter, you're left with bats that in many cases are starving to death or dying of exposure because they run out of energy.
And Jeff, this disease doesn't discriminate. This can impact any bat species. Is that correct?
As Owen indicated, it's just those bat species that are hibernating bats.
Okay.
Here in Wisconsin, we have 7 species of regularly occurring bats, and 3 of those species are migratory bats, so they're not hibernating locally here in the state. And those species have not been impacted to date. But species in eastern North America that hibernate are susceptible to white nose syndrome.
And Owen, you said that, a lot of bats, is it true that they come to Wisconsin for the winter? And is there any particular reason why, you know, Wisconsin gets a lot of these out-of-state bats that come to hibernate here in the winter?
Bats across the upper Midwest, yeah, they can travel quite a ways in the fall looking for hibernacular places to spend the winter. I guess we don't really know, where all the bats that spend the winter in Wisconsin are from. But we do know that in a number of cases now that it's very likely anyway that those bats have come from other places that were infected with white nose syndrome, because that's pretty likely how the disease got here to Wisconsin.
So now the DNR has confirmed that white nose syndrome is in 5 Wisconsin counties: Grant, Crawford, Richland, Door, and Dane County, mostly in the southwest. I mean, when you find them, do you find them infected? Are you finding dead bats?
Not so far. So the way that the disease progressed in the eastern states, and we're seeing the same pattern here, is that it usually takes maybe 2 or 3 years after that first initial discovery of the disease before we start seeing the large numbers of bats dying. And so in Wisconsin, as you mentioned, last year was the first year that we found white nose syndrome in the state. It was just at one site. And this year we've now found it expanded to 13 more sites, a total of 8 counties. So we're at the very early stage of infection here in Wisconsin. So we wouldn't expect to see the large die-offs, at least for another probably couple of years.
And Jeff, down in Grant County, where you are, where Platteville is, like as Owen said, you know, that's where the white nose syndrome was first discovered. And from what I understand, there's been a 70% decrease in the population. Can you explain that number and kind of what you're seeing down in Grant County?
I don't know that we have documented the 70% decrease of bats here in Grant County at this time. That may be more of a figure from the northeastern states. But we would expect, as Owen was suggesting, in the next few years that we would start seeing local declines here in the southwest part of the state. One of the things that's, you know, fortunately the Wisconsin DNR has been very involved in, and I've been involved in here at UW-Platteville in a smaller role, is trying to gather baseline data on bat populations. The DNR has been doing it across the state, and with students here at UW-Platteville, we've been doing stuff very locally around the Platteville area and in southwest Wisconsin, trying to get baseline data on what kind of healthy bat populations look like so that we can kind of accurately document the decline when it begins to take place.
So it might be a way to just really hyper-locally really investigate what's going on and how quickly everything's happening.
Right. I mean, aside from doing wintertime hibernacula counts where individuals can go in and actively count the bats and see how those numbers are declining from year to year, assessing summer populations is a totally different scenario. And that's something that folks are doing in a variety of ways, again, throughout the region where white-nose syndrome has been found. And that's maybe something that folks, you know, the average kind of homeowner may start to notice in the years ahead as bat populations decline to the region.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Today, we're talking about the spread of white-nose syndrome in Wisconsin. My guests are Jeff Hepschman. He's a professor in the Department of Biology at UW-Platteville. And Owen Boyle. He's a species management section chief with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So, Owen, there was fungus found, fungus that causes the disease, in Iowa, Dodge, and Lafayette counties. What exactly does that mean if we're just finding the fungus, but we're not necessarily finding bats infected with it?
Well, again, this is a pattern of spread that has been seen in the eastern states as well, and actually even in some of our neighboring states, including Minnesota and Iowa. The annual surveillance that we do is sort of two-parted when our teams go underground to survey the hibernacula during winter when bats are hibernating. They're both looking for signs of the disease, so those characteristic, you know, white fuzzy muzzles and that many people that you're seeing pictures of infected bats, but they're also taking environmental samples, and so which literally consists of essentially a large Q-tip. You're swabbing cave walls and cave floor, and that sample can then be analyzed through genetic techniques to find and isolate the genetics of the fungus itself. And so those counties where we haven't seen clinical signs of white-nose syndrome yet, but we have found essentially the genetic evidence that the fungus is there, they could stay that way for a few years. And again, this is, they've seen this out east and to the states immediately west of us where we first find the fungus, and it may be a few years before we actually see the full-blown white-nose syndrome in bats themselves.
And, like, when you find it in a cave or if you find the fungus in a mine, is there any way to clean or disinfect the cave?
Not so far, and that is the target of various research projects going on around the nation. There are a number of ways that researchers are trying to tackle the try and slow or even completely control the fungus, and so far none of the research has been really shown to be able to sort of disinfect the site.
Right, you probably can't just throw Clorox on a cave wall.
Right, I mean there's plenty of, you know, native biota, fungi and bacteria that are native there that, you know, it's part of the cave ecosystem. You wouldn't want to just completely wipe out that native ecosystem.
And does the same go for treatment of the bats? Like once a bat is found to have white nose syndrome, you can't just, you know, clean the fungus off of them, and there's no cure out there, and there is research underway to try to cure them that way too?
That's exactly right. Again, there are some early signs, some studies showing that there may be ways to at least slow the spread of the fungus and maybe give bats a chance to, you know, not wake up so frequently and make it through the winter, even though they are infected. But they're still in fairly early stages of lab and some really early field trials.
And Jeff Hitchman, can you talk a bit about how researchers think this is being spread at this point? I know Owen kind of touched on it earlier, but just the different ways that researchers are looking at this.
I think there's a couple of different hypotheses out there about how the fungus is getting spread. Again, you're dealing with microscopic fungal spores that can get on bats. So depending when a bat picks up the spores during hibernation. Say, for example, a bat is entering into hibernation, and one of the things that we know that happens is bats mate in the fall. So they might move into a cave or mine temporarily, and then if that's a site that has the fungal spores, and then they move on to another cave or mine that doesn't have the fungal spores and actually hibernate there, that's one scenario that might be spreading the fungus. The degree to which the fungal spores can persist throughout the summer months, I'm not sure where the data is on that. If the spores can land on a bat essentially during the winter time, and if a bat manages to survive that winter hibernation season, if they can sort of reinfect the site the following year, I believe actually some of the folks at the disease lab in Madison may have looked at that or are looking into that. And then the other scenario is unintentional spread by humans that might be sort of recreationally caving. If folks are going in to a site that has been infected, or if they're not aware that it might be infected, those individuals could pick up spores, again, on their clothing, on their boots, on caving equipment. And then if that equipment is not sort of properly disinfected, there's a chance that then they could move that to another site if they would use that same equipment to visit another location.
And Owen, the DNR has been working with mine and cave owners on developing white nose syndrome spread plans, correct?
Correct. Actually, any cave or mine that allows human use or human entry has to have a white nose control plan. And just as Jeff was pointing out, that consists mainly of a plan to essentially make sure that folks aren't using the same clothes, the same equipment, the same shoes in multiple caves or mines, you know, without at least detoxifying those clothes and equipment. We really recommend that folks have dedicated gear, and just so that it, you know, the clothes that you wear in one site don't go to a different site. And we've seen that bats don't even need to be present within a site in order for the fungus and the fungal spores to be spread. So whether bats are in a place or not doesn't necessarily mean the cave or mine can't already be infected.
So I'd imagine that, you know, people who are big-time spelunkers, they hopefully are aware of this and are being very mindful of it. But are there any, plans, or is education underway to really get this message out to maybe just recreational hikers, people who might not even think twice, like, oh, whatever, you know, I cleaned off my boots when I got home, I'll be fine next time I go out?
Yeah, and actually that's the purpose of those control plans, is that they're site-specific, and the owner of the cave or mine is responsible for doing that on-site education. And we provide information and brochures and other forms of info for those cave and mine owners to share.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Today, we're talking about the spread of white-nose syndrome in Wisconsin. My guests are Owen Boyle, he's a Species Management Section Chief with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Jeff Hipschman, he's the professor in Department of Biology at UW-Platteville. So, Jeff, you know, some people out there are scared of bats. Why should people care about, you know, the fact that this is happening to bats?
Lots of folks, thankfully, are becoming aware of the big role that bats play in our ecosystems as essentially free consumers of insects. All of the bats that we have in Wisconsin are insectivorous bats, so they're consuming insects, various species of beetles and small moths are a big part of that. And those insects, are prey of the bats, and they themselves may be predators of various plant species in different ways. So it's sort of a giant ripple effect. If we remove bats or if their numbers decline dramatically, how that will affect insect populations, and then how those insect populations may in turn affect other insect populations or plant populations. So I think one of the big things is we've got kind of a lot of unknowns on the horizon. And one of the things that we can say with certainty is there will be an impact, and it could be a very profound impact as we lose these bats that are consuming, you know, tons and tons and tons of insects on a regular basis. And I think, fortunately, again, a lot of folks are aware of that or becoming aware of that. And the economic impacts, I suppose, remain to be seen. But undoubtedly, there will be economic impacts as our bat populations decline.
I imagine it could have a huge impact on the ag industry.
Potentially so. There has been research that some bats, not necessarily bats that we have here in Wisconsin, but are primary consumers of pests that affect cotton crops, for example, in the southern states. Some of the beetles and moth species that may be prey of bats may be forest pests. There are some species of moths that in their larval stage may be boring into different kind of plants and be pest species. And so when the bats are gone and those insect populations decrease, there may be increased damage or an increased economic cost related to the need for more pesticides or more pesticide applications.
Jeff, I'm curious, just with the research that you and the students that you work with, the research that you do, does the emergence of white-nose syndrome in Wisconsin, does that change your focus? Or is that something that, you know, maybe in a couple of years you'll focus your attention differently?
The work that I've done here at UW-Platteville, which is an undergraduate institution, started years ago, really before white-nose syndrome was even in North America. I've been doing bat work in the state since around 2004. And a lot of it was initially just determining what the bat community looked like in this corner of the state. What were the species present? What were patterns related to reproductive patterns? And when are the young of the year first starting to fly? And one of the motivations, frankly, was to provide undergrads with a great research opportunity to get them out in the field and be involved in a research project. And as the years went on and we were starting to collect a nice baseline data set as to what our bat community looked like here in the state, then we started hearing along with other bat research around the country about white-nose syndrome. Its initial appearance on the scene and then subsequent spread. And now we've got a scenario where we have years of essentially baseline data, what our bat populations and bat community looks like in this corner of the state, a healthy bat community. And so we're in a position to actually sort of document the changes that may be coming as a result of white-nose syndrome. The decline, for example, in these hibernating species is something that we're in a position to see. So at this point, my hope is to continue essentially this long-term study into the foreseeable future and see how things play out.
And Owen, I'm assuming you and other researchers at the DNR probably bracing yourselves as white nose syndrome was slowly making its way across the U.S. But how has this, you know, now that it's really showing up in Wisconsin slowly, but it's here, how is this changing the work that you and your colleagues do?
Yeah, at this point, it really doesn't change things too significantly. As Jeff mentioned, you know, we've got this really great these surveys and have an idea of the baseline sort of pre-disease populations and distribution of the species in the state. And one of the really important reasons to continue that monitoring through the progression of the disease and hopefully afterward, you know, ideally if populations start to recover or if treatments are developed that help allow populations to recover, you know, we'll be able to track that and be able to quantify not only how populations are recovering, but how they're responding to potential treatment or white nose control measures.
And Owen, you said earlier that you all are anticipating that, you know, this will be killing off bats as the years go along. Is there anything that can be done in the meantime just to prevent the spread or just the different deaths? Is it waiting on research and waiting on a cure?
While we're waiting on research for, you know, control and treatment options, again, we continue to monitor the various species and their populations. We continue to, a number of those programs are citizen-based monitoring programs, and so we recruit and train volunteers to go out and, for example, count bats at roost sites in the summer, and it's actually a lot of fun. You sit outside with your family as the sun is setting and count bats as they come out for a night of eating insects. And another project is where folks go out and carry these really high-tech gadgets that that actually collect, they're able to hear the ultrasonic sounds that bats make as they're hunting those insects. And they carry those the equipment around, and from the data they collect, we can actually identify the species of bats that are flying overhead while they were doing that survey. And so those two are really important pieces of that overall picture of the population health of bats in Wisconsin. We already mentioned limiting the spread or the potential spread of the fungus. One other thing folks can do is to build roost boxes and put them up in good bat habitat. And, you know, so bats still need a place to go in the summer to have their young and raise those pups.
If people know they have bats in their attic or if someone has an old barn that bats live in, is there anything they should be concerned about?
No, there's nothing to be concerned about. If they have those roosts, it would be great. They could get on the DNR website and search for bats, and they can actually sign up and be a new site to be a roost monitor.
Jeff, I'm wondering if, just as we're kind of coming to a close, is there any other research you want to talk about that's underway that you hadn't mentioned before, or anything else that, you know, you and your students are looking at?
As I mentioned, mostly at this point, we're continuing the long-term monitoring. I would like to say, partly because of our location here in Platteville, I've been fortunate, and my students have been fortunate, to form some great partnerships with some of the folks within the Wisconsin DNR bat program. One project right along the lines of what Owen was just mentioning that students will be involved with is monitoring a local barn where there is a known summer bat roost, and the landowners have graciously allowed us to come out and track that population, so the students will be involved in emergent counts there. We've also marked a lot of those bats with little essentially microchips called pit tags. A lot of folks have their dogs and cats marked with these pit tags. Your vet may have done it, so it provides a unique identification number, and essentially you wave kind of a wand over the bat, and you can see if they've been tagged, and the number comes up. In this particular barn, where the bat bats are roosting, the students can go into the barn. The bats are on the other side of the wall, really between an original wall and some metal siding, and can keep track of individual bats as they're moving around. And one of the things we're doing is just kind of tracking some individuals over a matter of years, and also kind of just exploring this marking technique. So that's been a great opportunity for students, and again, a great partnership that we've been able to develop with the bat crew in the Wisconsin DNR.
Owen, is there anything else that you want to talk about or that you want people to know just regarding white-nose syndrome and our bat population here in Wisconsin?
I'd reiterate that, first of all, white-nose syndrome is not a threat to people. It's not a human health issue. People can't get it. Other animals can't get it. It's strictly in our bats. You know, if you do head underground, please check in with that landowner and see what their white-nose control plan says and follow the information that they provide.
Owen Doyle is a species management section chief with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jeff Hipschman is a biology professor at UW-Platteville. They spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's Maureen McCollum about the spread of the often lethal white-nose syndrome and its impact on bats in southwestern Wisconsin's Driftless region. Coming up, we move to western Wisconsin's Jackson County, where efforts to reestablish a herd of elk have felt some recent setbacks. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to additional information about white-nosed syndrome in Wisconsin. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share a comment or make suggestions for future shows, you can find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.